Welcome to Life in Debt, your practical debt education program. This is bankruptcy attorney Robert Liptak. I'm speaking from Crew LP, 100.1 FM, the voice of Fairfield, Iowa, an award-winning, listener-supported, open-source, grassroots, and partially solar-powered community radio station broadcasting from the Cultural District in Fairfield. Please note that these presentations are provided as a public service for general information purposes only and are not intended to be legal opinions, legal advice, or complete discussions of any legal issues. Remember, every individual's factual situation is different, and you should seek independent legal advice from an attorney familiar with the laws of your state or locality regarding specific information. The name of this show is Life in Debt, and it is a weekly half-hour educational show looking at all types of issues related to debt as it influences your life. This show provides practical, general knowledge about what to look for regarding debt, what are its traps and pitfalls, and what to do to be an educated debtor. Please get some notebook, paper, and pen so you can take notes during the show. First, I look at some debt-related news and facts for the week. For those of you who have listened to this show before, you know that I am a very firm supporter and great fan of Professor Elizabeth Warren from Harvard. This past week, she actually was interviewed by Stephen Colbert on Colbert Nation, and I'd like to play a portion of that interview for your education and entertainment.
Please welcome Elizabeth Warren. Coming on. I'm looking forward to talking to you for a long time. Now, madam, you've held a vaunted position in American politics and finance, okay? You have been chair of the Congressional Oversight Panel that basically looks over the shoulder of the TARP people to see how everything is being distributed. How did that go?
Well, we're still in the middle.
How far are we?
We're about three quarters of the way through.
And how much money is that?
It started out at $700 billion. We expect we're going to get all of it back. Right now, we've got about $137 billion outstanding.
So we've been paid back?
We've been paid back much of it, not all of it.
How much is that?
About $137 billion.
About $137 billion out of over $700 billion.
Well, it never all actually went out of $700 billion that was allocated.
Okay, so but still, do you expect to get the rest of the hundred and something billion back?
Well, it kind of depends on things like how the auto industry does, because we're big
GM's
owners.
GM's paid everything back, they said, with interest. You've seen the commercials, right?
I have.
They've paid everything back. If that wasn't true, they couldn't run that commercial. That's the law, madam.
We actually are big shareholders in GM and mm-hmm. hoping to sell our share to someone else mm-hmm. As a way to get paid back.
Okay.
So we're working on that. We're working on Chrysler. There's AIG. There's Citibank. Mm-hmm. And then there are a few other, GMAC, a few other financial institutions not doing so well.
You believe that there's a banking and financial regulation bill that the Democrats want to jam down America's throat. And you're in favor of this bill, correct?
I am in favor of a change in the financial rules.
Okay, now the old financial rules gave us years of unbelievable boom. We just had a huge boom over the last 10 years, correct?
Yeah, well, yeah.
Except for the last 2 years.
Except for that part.
The first eight of the last 10 years. Pretty great, right?
Well,
right?
Not so much. Because,
how so?
Well, now we've sort of moved into what we might call the boom and bust cycle. And that works for some people. Some people get really rich during that.
Worked out great for me, baby.
It didn't work so well for a lot of middle-class American families. Unemployment, bankruptcy, foreclosures, a down economy, flat wages, rising
expenses. So what do you want to
expenses.
Do to the banks to hamstring them so they can't make profit?
Well, the idea behind the regulation is to try to put some rules back on Wall Street and rein them in a little bit.
So no free market?
No. This is to support a free market. And it starts
rules,
on...
Rules? You said rein in.
That's right.
A free horse has no reins on it. Okay, we're talking Mustangs. You want a gelded, you know, Clydesdale.
Well, what I want is a horse that works for all of us. I want a...
Oh, the horse belongs to all of us.
No.
Comrade.
I want a strong, consumer agency to
what would
make
they do?
Sure. What they would do is make sure that we can all read our credit card agreements.
Can you read your credit card agreement?
Not the ones we have now. They're about 30 pages long, tiny little print.
You're a professor of contract law at Harvard University.
That's right.
And you can't read them.
That's right. It's designed not to be read.
And you want to make me read mine.
No, I actually think we should change the contracts so that you could read yours. The idea is that everyone should have, we should have simple products that we can read, like two-page credit card agreements, two-page mortgage agreements.
Explain to a conservative why he should support curtailing the ability of banks to do anything they want.
Well, because conservatives believe in markets, and the way markets work with contracts is that you understand it and I understand it. We decide to make contracts that are in both of our interests. So the idea is just to level the playing field here a little bit. You get to understand the contract, personal responsibility, make a decision if that's a contract you should take on.
But if I'm the bank, don't I get to change the contract anytime I want?
Well, that's one of the things that makes it not like real contract law. I believe in
contracts. Because I'm fine you understanding the contract as long as I get to change that understanding without telling you.
Well, that...
Isn't that how it works now?
And that's a problem.
And that's working out for the banks.
It's working out for the banks, but it's not working out so well for millions and millions of American families.
Now, the Democrats have this financial reform package.
That's
right. Republicans have a financial reform package too. Let's hear about that one. Say a couple positive things about that.
Well, so the idea behind the Republican Consumer Agency is that they will take the heads of all the agencies that failed and brought us to this economic crisis,
yes,
the folks who were asleep on the job and didn't protect consumers,
yes,
and they'll put them in a committee and put the committee in charge.
They know the lay of the land, though. They know.
They do.
You know, why do we need reform? Don't we? Why do we need to regulate the banks? Don't we have bank regulators now? There's something called bank regulators. I've heard that term bandied about. Why do we have to wear a belt with our suspenders? We already have one set of regulators.
No, actually, right now we don't have any pants on. I mean,
on that note. Ms. Warren, thank you so much for joining me. Evidently, we have a new financial future. Elizabeth Warren, we'll be right back.
So that was just a small snippet from Colbert Nation. You can listen to the whole program, colbertnation.com, where Steve Colbert interviews Elizabeth Warren. What Professor Warren is attempting to do is get a regulatory system that can actually create transparency for particularly middle-class people. When we understand the system, we can see how important this is. Here's a statement from former regulator and white-collar criminologist William K. Black that helps to clarify the point. Mr. Black, quote, "Fraudulent lenders produce exceptional short-term profits through a four-part strategy: extreme growth, which is Ponzi, lending to uncreditworthy borrowers, extreme leverage, and minimal loss reserves. These exceptional profits defeat regulatory restrictions and turn private market discipline perverse. The profits also allow the CEO to convert firm assets for personal benefit through seemingly normal compensation mechanisms. The short-term profits cause stock options to appreciate. Fraudulent CEOs follow this strategy are guaranteed extraordinary income while minimizing risks of detection and prosecution." And that's from William K. Black at the University of Missouri, Kansas City Law School. What he's pointing out is that the investment banks and other financial institutions bulked up on garbage loans and complex securities backed by dodgy mortgages so they could increase leverage and rake off large bonuses for themselves. They knew the underlying collateral was junk, just as they knew that eventually the market would crash and millions of people would suffer. That's all part of a very complex understanding of what has happened over the last 10, 15 years. But what Professor Warren is attempting to do is to get some regulation over all of this so it does not happen again. So that's all some food for thought. If you're just tuning in, this is bankruptcy attorney Robert Liptak, and this program is Life and Debt, your practical debt education program. I'm speaking from Crew LP 100.1 FM, the voice of Fairfield, Iowa, and beyond. Now, I'd like to go back to what we have been studying for some weeks, The Two-Income Trap, Why Middle-Class Parents Are Going Broke, by Elizabeth Warren and her daughter, Amelia Warren Tyagi, whom I credit because the thoughts, ideas, and examples used in this program are directly from or based on the work, theories, and books of Professor Warren and her daughter, two of America's leading champions for debtors. I do highly recommend their books, All Your Worth and The Two-Income Trap. You can also revisit all of the shows that have been produced for Life and Debt. Go to www.kruufm.com under the archives, Life and Debt, and you can get caught up with all of the gems of information I've been sharing on dealing with debt. Now, last week from The Two-Income Trap, I was talking about the debt explosion. And as Professor Warren points out, that we have a new world of unregulated lending. And as a result, families are barraged with advertisements and offers for new products. All the debt they could ever want and more was the result. We see that there are over 5 billion pre-approved credit card offers being made every year, which is more than $350,000 of credit offers per family per year, which are pouring into American homes. We see magazine ads, telephone calls, flyers at the bottom of grocery store bags, internet emails offering credit. We also know if we have kids in college that there are credit card marketers everywhere on campuses and in the local shopping malls trying to give kids credit cards, people who do not even have jobs. So the bottom line was that credit card debt in the last several decades has increased phenomenally from less than $10 billion in 1968 to more than $600 billion in the year 2000 and pushing $900 billion today for revolving credit alone. So mathematically, this is a jump of about 9,000% increase in debt for credit cards since 1968. Professor says, it seems once Americans got a first bite of the debt apple, they just couldn't get enough. But when we look at it at a deeper level, we ask, are families spending money on things they shouldn't be? Did they blow it on vacations and luxury items? We hear that a lot, particularly from self-righteous bill payers who claim they are superior and responsible and everyone else is getting over on the system. But Professor Warren shows that it doesn't square with facts. Certainly, all that easy credit dangling under everyone's noses enticed a few more Americans into buying things they could have lived without. Yet today, families are spending more on some goods such as computers, home electronics, and pet foods than they did a generation ago, while at the same time they're spending less on food, clothing, appliances, home furnishings, and tobacco, a lot less. There is absolutely no evidence of an increase in impulse buying or luxury acquisitions over the past 40 years. And that's certainly nothing that could account for a 9,000% increase in credit card debt. The expenditures that have shown the biggest increases are housing, health insurance, college tuition, and preschool. Now, these are the things that are least likely to appear on a credit card bill. That leads to the next inquiry. Well, if families aren't buying more goods, what are they using all of that debt for? Well, the professor says that they got into debt trying to buy their way out of the two-income trap. As we discussed before, the bidding war has inflated the cost of middle-class life to a point that once they have paid the mortgage and other fixed expenses, families have little discretionary income left and even less margin for error. They want their kids to be in the best place possible, to be in the proper school for their kids, and as a result, paid a lot more for their home than they could probably afford. And then what can a person do? What can a family do when something goes wrong? which inevitably something does go wrong for all of those of us who have families. Well, since the two-income family does not have a stay-at-home mom to call on to help make ends meet, when emergency strikes, the family turns to debt to make it through to the next payday. We don't see advertisements that say, when your husband leaves you, there's MasterCard or American Express. Don't lose your job without it. But according to the professor, those slogans would be closer to the truth about how credit is used today. And as a bankruptcy attorney reviewing files, I see this is absolutely true. It's a known fact when people feel that corporate layoffs are about to happen, they're going to lose their job. Workers do apply for as many credit cards as possible to see them through until they can find a new one, that is a new job. When health insurance lapses, the family hands a MasterCard to the doctor and prays for the best. And when dad or mom leaves the house and the separation starts, that easy check stuffed into the latest credit card bill looks like something to tide one over until the child support starts coming. Eventually, the credit card payments become unmanageable, and the family takes on a second mortgage to consolidate all the debt. And again, this does not come out in the advertisements and not generally in the media. No one would suspect it from looking at the ads that for every family taking out a second mortgage to pay for a vacation, there are at least 61 more families taking on a second mortgage so they can pay down their credit card bills and medical debt. Now, as an aside, this is a huge mistake for the stability of a family, particularly in Iowa, where home equity is exempt from creditors when that debt came after they got the house. And that exemption is unlimited. The house could have been totally paid for and have $300,000, $500,000 of equity in it, and a creditor can touch it. But most importantly, it's the homestead. It's the family home. It's a place of security. One should not risk it by paying for unsecured debt, like taking out a second mortgage and paying down their credit card bills, or even medical debt for that matter. People do want to pay their debts. It's a very real sentiment. But you don't trade off the things that are necessaries and security platforms for things that can be dealt with within the boundaries of the law to the family's benefit. In short, you don't risk security for unsecured debt. We just have to look at the bankruptcy courts, which really offer a peek at those in the most trouble with debt. We talked about the myth of the immoral debtor in the past, which would have us believe that these families consumed their way into bankruptcy, running up their credit cards to cover their reckless spending. Yes, it is true that families in bankruptcy are generally choking on credit card debt. 91% of the families in bankruptcy were carrying balances on their cards by the time they filed, according to the statistics from Professor Warren. Yet a third of homeowners were carrying second or even third mortgages or had refinanced their mortgages to get some cash. What did they do with the cash? They deal with the unsecured debt for the most part. The amount of debt, regardless, is staggering. Nearly one-third of bankruptcy filers, between 400 to 450,000 families, owe at least an entire year's salary on their credit cards when they file, which is a hole that is virtually impossible to dig a generation ago. No one could have done this. But was it for reckless spending? That's the question. If you're just tuning in, this is bankruptcy attorney Robert Liptak, and this program is Life and Debt, your practical debt education program. I'm speaking from Crew LP, 100.1 FM, the voice of Fairfield, Iowa, and beyond. Critics often say that it is reckless spending, that there's overconsumption, or it's trouble managing money, People don't know how to deal with their money. Professor Warren did some very rigid statistical analysis in 2001, and looking at these two reasons combined, overconsumption and trouble managing money, they accounted for less than 6% of families in bankruptcy. So what about the rest? Well, the overwhelming majority of bankrupt families face far more serious problems than credit card use due to overconsumption or bad management skills. She showed that nearly 90% of people in bankruptcy had been felled by a job loss, a medical problem, or a family breakup, or by some combination of all three of these. So for all those people who assert that overspending and an unwillingness to live within one's means causes debt, we can respond to the glimmer of truth in that by saying that families certainly overspent, accepting medical care they could not afford and making child support payments that left them with too little to pay the rent. They also lived beyond their means by trying to hold on to their houses and cars even after they lost their jobs. But the response to that is, what could these families have done? What alternative did they have? Not gone to the emergency room when the chest pain started? Moved the kids into a shelter the day their father moved out? Paid MasterCard and Visa even if it meant not feeding the kids? One real challenge in our society is that it is doubtlessly satisfying to point the long finger of blame at personal irresponsibility and overspending. But, as Professor Warren concludes, only the willfully ignorant refuse to acknowledge the real reasons behind all of that debt. Now, last week we discussed the interest rate deregulation and how this dovetailed neatly with a seemingly unrelated phenomenon, the bidding war for suburban housing, which we talked about in the past. The mortgage industry shook off its interest rate regulations just a few years after the credit card industry. In the new world of unfettered mortgage lending, no longer would the middle-class family be restricted to a conventional 80% mortgage. Essentially, the floodgates were opened and families could get all the mortgage money they ever dreamed of to bid on that precious home in the suburbs, even if the price tag was more than they could realistically afford. In middle-class suburban America, competition for houses in good neighborhoods has always been stiff, and overloading on mortgage debt to purchase a better home has long posed the temptations, particularly for young families. As we mentioned in the past, a generation ago, it simply wasn't possible to give in to that temptation. Mortgage lenders didn't allow it. But the game that we've seen in the last decade was just the opposite. They pushed the loans. It became routine for lenders to issue unmanageable mortgages. Now, if we look at the mortgage industry itself, Fannie Mae, the quasi-governmental agency that underwrites a huge fraction of home mortgage lending in the United States, advises families that monthly housing expenses should not represent more than 25 to 28% of gross monthly income. Accordingly, anyone whose housing costs exceed 40% of their earnings would be considered house poor, spending so much on housing that they jeopardize their overall financial security. But according to Professor Warren, the label is misleading. Many of the house poor are not poor at all. They are middle-class families that overextended themselves in a desperate effort to find a home in the midst of a fearsome bidding war. Over the past generation, at the same time that millions of households sent a second earner into the workforce, the proportion of middle-class families that would be classified as house poor or near poor has quadrupled. We don't see, for example, the down payment. Once a critical device for screening potential borrowers, it's virtually disappeared right up to the recent mortgage bust. in the mid-1970s, first-time home buyers put down, on the average, 18% of the purchase price in order to get a mortgage. By the turn of the century, that figure shrunk to just 3%, and right up until 2007, 2008, with all the exotic mortgages and the fraud that was associated with creating those mortgages, such as over-appraising the value of a house, and as a result giving people more money than the house was even worth, in fact, with no down payment, became quite regular. Well, while a small down payment may sound appealing to those who remember scrimping and saving before a home could be purchased, the truth is, as we have seen, on a much more ominous side. The family that couldn't come up with a down payment paid higher points and fees, and many were forced by their lenders to purchase additional credit insurance. These things still happened. These kinds of families received mortgages they could not have gotten a generation ago, but in truth, they've paid a lot more for them, even if they didn't wind up in foreclosures. And it is a fact that families that don't make a down payment are much more likely to lose their homes, which is why traditional lenders require the 20% down payment in the first place. According to one study cited by Professor Warren, families that make a down payment of less than 5% of the purchase price are 15 to 20 times more likely to default than those who put down 20% or more. I personally thought with the onslaught of all these mortgages, we would have an immediate reversal back to the day when the conservative standards for giving mortgages were going to reign supreme. But still, deregulation continues to reign supreme. Even as the defaults are rising, people can still get mortgages with exotic qualities to them, including no down payments, minimal down payments, or absurd options, for example, interest-only payments on the loan. When we project this into the future, these will still cost millions of families their chance at staying in those houses they are buying. So with mortgages as the regulatory control over interest rates collapsed, a new industry was born, which we've all seen, the subprime mortgage lender. Subprime lenders specialize in issuing high-interest mortgages to families with spotty credit who are unlikely to qualify for traditional low-cost prime mortgages. At least that's the theory behind it. It turns out that a lot of people who did qualify for prime mortgages, particularly in minority groups, were steered to subprime mortgages, which I've talked about on prior shows. When deregulation first started, subprime mortgage lending didn't exist. But by the mid-1990s, banking giants such as Chase and Citibank, which were overloaded with profits from credit card lending, were looking for new markets to tap. So they applied the same principles to home mortgage lending that had profited their credit card decisions so handsomely. Charge high interest rates and sell, sell, sell. And an important point is that they were not only selling the mortgages to borrowers, they were taking the mortgages and promissory notes after they were signed and selling them to investors. So these big lenders were actually out of the picture right from the beginning. In short, the overwhelming lust for profits by the big corporations, the big mortgage lenders, which trickled down to small mortgage lenders, became the rule of the day with no regulation and the total mess that we are involved with now. And we'll continue our journey through this quagmire next week. This is bankruptcy attorney Robert Liptak, and you have been listening to Life in Debt, your debt education program. If you have any questions or comments, call the station at 641-209-1083, or you can email me at lifeanddebt@gmail.com. I'm speaking from Crew LP 100.1 FM, the voice of Fairfield, Iowa. May you enjoy and have a healthy and prosperous debt manageable life.